Session number 959.
Brigadier Armstrong, Reel 1. How did you come to join the army in the first place, Brigadier Armstrong?
Well, my recollection from very, very early age, I decided to join the army. No, I decided to join the navy, and then as a small child, I went out in a rowing boat and was violently sick, so I decided to join the army. I have various relations in the army, Indian Army and the British service, and I did think at one time of trying to join the Indian Army, but I missed it by one place and ended up in the British service, joining the East Surrey Regiment, because I happened to have an uncle in that regiment at the time.
What was the family connection with the Indian Army?
Indian Army connection. Well, I had two aunts, both married to Indian Army officers, sisters of my father. I had an uncle who was in the Indian Army, and he was a relation of my mother. So on both sides of the family, there were people who with connections in the Indian Army. That's why I thought at one time. Also, in those days, the Indian Army got better pay, and you could do more in the Indian Army than you could in the British service. But I'm very glad now that I ended up in the British service, actually. Not that I have anything against the Indian Army other than admiration, but it so happened that I joined the British service.
And what had your uncles told you about soldiering in India before you went?
I must confess that I didn't hear very much. They were not often in England. They had leave back to England occasionally, and then I was either at school or away. But the aunts, they seemed to enjoy life very much in the Indian Army, and by reputation, the Indian soldier was a very good soldier to have under your command. And life in India was pleasant socially, and also there was a chance of a certain amount of service if you got up on the frontier. I suppose that really was the reason I had thought of joining the Indian Army originally.
When did you hear that you were going to India?
Oh, now, after the First World War, I came back to... I was a prisoner, by the way. I was wounded and captured by the Germans in their advance in March 18. And I got back to England by December and had a spot of leave. And then while I was on leave, I was in the machine gun corps then. I was seconded for service with the machine gun corps. And a brother officer who was also in the machine gun corps happened to be going out to India with a battalion of the machine gunners. And he asked me if I'd like to join, so I was still seconded to the machine gun corps, so a transfer was arranged to join the 7th Battalion of the machine gun corps, who were going out to India at the beginning of 1919, end of 18, beginning of 19. No, I beg your pardon, if I'm not wasting tape. Early in 1919, about March 1919, I went out in HM Transport, Derbyshire, to India with the battalion.
And what was your reaction when you heard you were going to India? Were you pleased?
Oh, of course I was, yes. Oh, rather. I think in those days, the majority of people who were lucky to be posted to India were pleased to be so posted. Oh, yeah, definitely.
And did you have to make any special preparations for going to India in the way of kitting out or anything like that?
Well, I'm afraid in those days one didn't worry very much about special preparations. I got a certain amount of drill clothing, but mostly you bought out in India your drill clothing and your thin civvies, jackets and trousers and shirts and things like that, you generally got for the Indian Dersey, who was normally worked for the battalion that you were serving with. Each Dersey, each tailor seemed to have a contract to work with the battalion, and you just got your bearer to send for the dirty. He came to your bungalow and you said, measure me up for whatever you wanted. And in two shakes of duck's wagger, he had the thing ready for you. They were very, very quick producing any clothing you'd ordered. I think possibly my original, shall we say, khaki drill jacket thing I probably got from Hawks in England. And then in India, they copied this clothing very, very well indeed. They copied your English suits very well. Can't think of anything in particular in those days that worried one about getting kitted up. One certainly didn't go and buy a whole lot of stuff in England, A, because you hadn't got the money to do so, and B, because anyone who had been in India told us that we could always get the stuff in India without any difficulty whatever.
Did the army itself officially give you any information about India or what to do and what not to do there before you went?
I have no recollection at all of getting any pamphlet or official information from the army sources. All one's information, I think, was gathered from people who'd been out there before. A few officers were still serving who went out there before. My company, original company commander, he'd been out in India, and I distinctly recollect another company commander who was in the British service had been out in India before the war. And they was more or less our source of information, really. There was no great worry by people in those days, at least I never heard of any or saw any, about going out to India as if you were going to some unknown land, you didn't know what would happen. You were very well briefed by the officers who had been there before.
And what was it like on the troop ship going out to India?
Well, even in those days, it was a little tough. Going through the Red Sea and across the Indian Ocean, it was damned hot. You had one or two of those big sail, I don't know what they were, canvas funnels were erected on the mast, which gathered a little breeze and took it down to the toop decks. But it was very hot down there for the soldiers indeed. And the fans weren't very common. There were fans here and there, not electric fans, but the sort of a punker type of a fan. It may have been one or two electric fans in the saloon, but certainly in your cabin, you hadn't any air conditioning that you get nowadays. No, they were hot. They were hot at times.
Was it a boring journey?
As a subaltern officer that I was then, you had duties. You, I suppose, about every 3 days or 4 days, your turn came round as the officer of the watch. You were three of you on, 4 hours and eight off, sort of thing. Or it might be 2 hours and four off. During that period of time, at least once each hour, you had to go round all the sentries on board ship. There might be 18 or 20 sentry posts, men on charge of the water taps, men that on the forecastle to see that soldiers didn't go and fall in by looking over the rails in front where the anchors were, people on duty by the naffy, well, it wasn't a naffy then, by the canteen, such as it was, or on stores or baggage entrances, things like that, various duties to stop the general soldier, officer, and people intruding into places which were out of bounds, shall we say. I don't know if I can intrude here by saying, after about two or three days, my first time on, I had a good bump of locality, and talking to a brother officer, I said, I think I could go round all the sentry posts blindfolded, you see. And he said, I bet you fiver you can't. Well, fiver was a hell of a lot of money in those days, you see. I said, well, why don't I take you on? So we arranged after lunch one day that I was going to be blindfolded, I was blindfolded on the saloon deck, it was, and I set off with my brother officer, a fellow called Yeo, behind me, and I did. I could picture in my mind where every man was, down the troop shed, down the troop deck, and on the decks and in the, and I went round, and when I got to the end, which was the last post up in the forecastle, and took the bandages off, I found about half the battalion had been following round behind me. They'd been very good. I hadn't a clue that anyone was following me. Everyone was so silent. Anyhow, I got my fibre.
When you arrived in India, was it at Bombay?
Yes. Yes, we got off at Bombay, and we were going off to the east side of India to a small station called Dinapore. But when we got to Bombay, we had orders to send one company to a place called Dum Dum near Calcutta, and the other three companies went to Dinapore. The company I was in, which happened to have a company commander who had been to India before, was sent off to Dum Dum. We all went by train, of course. Well, when we got to Dum Dum, we detrained and prepared to march to the barracks. Well, we did march to the barracks, but the barracks were, as it has so happened, old barracks, pre-war barracks, which had been evacuated because they'd had cholera there, and so all the troops had been evacuated from the barracks. No one expected us there. No one knew we were coming. There were no other soldiers there. There was no station staff, officer, anyone. So we marched to the barracks and just occupied what looked like the particular barrack in the best state of repair, and settled our company in and the troops in. They had plenty of room then. And then my company commander said, "Now we've got to fix up an officer's mess." And we said, "What should we do?" Well, we walked up the one road there was in Dum Dum, and we looked at each bungalow as we went by and decided we'd go into the largest bungalow we saw and see if they could help us in any way. So the very last bungalow at the end of one road there was went in, and a fellow called Drake Brockman was in there, and when he heard our tale of woe, that we had nowhere to live, he said, "Oh, well, of course you can form a mess here." And we were very thankful, and he introduced us to Bidgley, his bearer. Bidgley means lightning. He was an old man, and as you imagine, he was very far from the lightning, but he would call Bidgley. There's one point about that. Drake Brockman was the officer in charge, or his civilian. He was the officer in charge of the ammunition factory at Dum Dum. I don't know if there was any relation between the name of Dum Dum and the bullets that had that name. But the funny part was, before we set out for India, I'd been with the advance party of the battalion who'd sent to Plymouth to make preparations for the rest of the battalion when they came down and put to board a troop ship. We walked into the garrison gunner's mess there, which was occupied, and there was one officer there, a major, and he said, "Hello, what do you want?" He said, "Well, we've come down, we're told to report here, preparatory to the battalion, coming down to get into troopship Derbyshire." He said, "All right, sir, my name is Drake Brockman," he said. He said, "Oh, yes." He said, "Oh, by the way, if you ever meet my brother in India, give him my kind regards." Well, we said, "Oh, yes, rather, certainly would. But India is a rather large place, and to expect to meet his brother was, I thought, a bit optimistic." Anyhow, by extraordinary coincidence, at Dum Dum, he didn't even say his brother was at Dum Dum. At Dum Dum, we walked into the first bungalow occupied by a white man, shall we say, which was his brother, who greeted us with open arms and let us have a mess there.
What were the barracks like?
Barracks then were two stories. There were about four blocks. They were absolutely empty because all the furniture and everything, bedding and everything, had been removed when they were... They must have been unoccupied for a good many years. There was no sign of occupation in them at all. I can't remember now how we set about getting charpoys and beds and bedding for the troops, but anyhow, we did so. It probably came from Calcutta, which wasn't very far away, which was occupied by a British battalion with their services, and I expect supplies and kit and bedding and such like probably came from Auden's at Calcutta. But they were absolutely empty. No sign at all of previous occupation.
And what were your own quarters like there?
Our own quarters? Well, we went into one of these barrack blocks. There were about four or five, which were much more accommodation than was required for one company. We just occupied the end of one barrack block, put down our camp beds, and settled there, and messed in Drake Brockman's bungalow.
And what did you? How did you recruit your servants while you were there at Dum Dum?
Well, no difficulty at all. You'd have more than you wanted. As soon as they knew that Saabs were there who wanted bearers, they turned up. I was lucky, actually, because my uncle, uncle who was in the Indian Army, happened to be on leave, and he told his bearer that if he'd like to contact me, he's quite certain I would employ him. So I had the advantage of having an old, well-trusted and well-trained bearer for my uncle, who was then a major in the Indian Army. Perhaps I was exceptionally lucky in that respect. No difficulty at all in getting servants.
And later, when you went back to India for the second time, you were a married man. How many servants did you employ then?
Oh, heavens. Do you want them in Indian names, if I can remember them?
Yes.
Well, first of all, there was the bearer. Am I to explain what their duties were, so to speak, or will people know what I mean? I better say what they were. There was the bearer. And then I had a chokra. Now, he was a youngster, probably might have been anything between 13 and 16. I don't know what his age was. He was a prospective bearer in the years to come. He started training. He worked under my bearer. He would probably clean the boots. He might be used to clean the silver. He also did a job of caddying for my wife on the golf course. She carried her clubs around. He was sort of general slave, factotum, whatever you like to call it, who was under and being trained by the bearer. So that's why so often you get a young fellow coming along as bearer who has had previous experience of what is expected of him. Then I had a fellow called a Masalchi. Now, the Masalchi used to wait at table. He would clean silver. He would work only, shall we say, in the public rooms. He didn't do any bearer work. He was rarely your waiter table and general cleaner-up of, as I say, the silver, whatever it may be. Then in the kitchen, there was, of course, the Bawachi, the cook. He worked under the bearer is in charge of everyone. If you wanted to, you could issue orders to anyone through the bearer, and that was really customary for people who were fresh in India and didn't talk the language. There was a cook. Then the cook had working under him, or for him, shall we say, as well, Masalchi, the waiter fellow, who would also help the cook prepare food in the kitchen. Then there was the beastie. He was responsible for your water supply. No one else dealt with water. It was his job and his alone. He would supply water for the cook. He'd supply water for the occupants of the bungalow, and bath water, and things like that, and hot water. Then you had the sweeper. Now, the sweeper, well, he, self-description, he was responsible for sweeping all the dust from point A to point B, you see, and if he could collect it, he'd take it away. You see. He would remove any dirt and dust that was required to be removed. He'd sweep inside the house, and he'd sweep outside the house as well. Then there was the syce.
as machine gunners, machine gun officers, we each had a pony, which was very nice. And Seiss was responsible, he was the groom, he was responsible for feeding and looking after your horse and also cleaning the saddlery. Then you had the chowkidar. A chowkidar had the privilege of going to sleep at night. He rarely was supposed to be the night watchman. If you employed a chowkidar, it was to a certain extent a guarantee that your bungalow wouldn't be robbed because you were employing another Indian. He would come on duty just before it got dark, and you supplied him with a butty, a lamp, oil lamp, and that was part of his equipment. He always had a big stick with him. I don't suppose they ever wanted to use it or did, but it was part of his badge of office, shall we say. His job was to patrol around your bungalow at night time and see that you didn't lose anything. Generally, if you'd been out at night time and came back, he'd be awake because he knew you were coming back. If you weren't going out for the night, the possibility is that probably about 11 or 12 o'clock he'd take his shoes off and sit on the veranda and go to sleep on the veranda. But he was, to a certain extent, not a guarantee, but insurance against being robbed. Now, who else have we got? The dobie. Every day, you had your own dobie, washerman. Every day he'd come to your bungalow and collect all the washing, the bedding sheets, your clothes, all the Memsahib's clothing that you want washing by him, and take them away and bring it back at night time, beautifully clean, dried by the sun, almost bleached by the sun, and no difficulty at all about the dobie. Let me think. I've done the chowkidar, the Seiss, the dobie, Kit McGar, the Solche, Cook, Piste, Bearer. I think that is more or less the whole lot of them.
Someone to look after the garden?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Yes, bright idea. Yes, the Marley. Oh, and there's one other too. The Marley, he looked after the garden, watered the garden. I never had any dealings with him. My wife, of course, dealt with him to a certain extent, or asked a bearer to tell him to do this and do that. And then as part of the Marley, there was also the grass cutter. If you had a horse, Bernie, you employed a grass cutter because there was no available grazing for your horse. He'd go off somewhere near the river and with a sack on him and a little brunt tool and scrape the ground and get what grass he could, bring it back for your horse. I really think that is the lot now. I can't remember how many it is.
Who looked after the children?
Who looked after the children? Well, generally, the wife did. But she had, very often, she had a nurse who normally didn't bath and put the child to bed. She might do a certain thing, but she'd take it out for a walk and look after it by the day and allow herself to be bullied by the child or children and that sort of thing, and watch it play. And it was generally very useful acting in that respect, looking after the safety of the child, depending on each age, of course, while Memsahib was, shall we say, elsewhere. Not everyone had them. Of course, you didn't have one unless you got a young child, a baby or a young child up to 5, 6, or 7 years of age or so on. Perhaps you've got another bright idea. I can't think of anyone at the moment.
What about these nurses? Were they Indians? Or
definitely Indian. On the other hand, some people, we were very lucky indeed, actually, because we got a very good Swedish woman who had been in hospital as a nurse, and she stayed on with us the whole time we were in India until my wife went home. And she was very, very good for my wife, because during the hot weather, the women folk went up to the hills, and very often the men folk had to stay on the plains. And she spoke, this Swedish one we had, spoke first-class Hindustani, Urdu, and so helped my wife very much indeed at running the bungalow up in the hills, because my wife went up to Mysore and also went up to, from Rawalpindi up to Srinagar, where she got a bungalow, and this Swedish nurse helped her very much in the organization of servants and looking after servants and issuing orders to the servants up there. But not everyone was lucky as we were in that respect of getting this white woman who was very knowledgeable, very patient, a fluent speaker of Urdu, and invaluable to us.
And was it an advantage to you, the fact that she'd had this medical training?
She'd had medical training.
Was that
great advantage? Yes, because that's right. Our first child was born when we down on the plains at a place called Faizabad. And there was what they called a third-class hospital. Hospitals in India were first, second, or third class. And as far as we could see, the equipment supplied to the hospital was in proportion to the class of hospital. In other words, a third-class hospital probably only had one syringe, whereas a first-class hospital probably had three syringes. It worked all like that. And that when it came the time to inoculate our small child, I suppose, what against? I don't know, cholera or something it was, probably, no doubt. The doctor came along and produced a syringe with a great hook on the end of it, which, they tell me he got a hook on the end. And our Swedish nurse was terribly indignant and refused to let him touch the daughter, and rushed off to her own room and produced a proper syringe for which the child was inoculated. But I don't think that was always by any means the case. But it so happened that this one case where she was a very great help to us. Illness, my wife was very lucky. She was never seriously ill, and the child was never seriously ill. But the Swedish nurse would have been very, very useful if we had had any ill health in the family. Oh, yes, without a doubt.
What about your bearer when you were a married man? What was he called?
What's he called? Well, his name was Mohammed Bux. Here's the bearer I got before I married, and then I married, and he met me again when I came back to India, and stayed with us the whole time. And when I left, he went off somewhere to get another job. I left. When did I leave? When did the war break out? 1939, 38. I left in 38 to go to Khartoum, and Mohammed Bux went off up to Pindi, and we exchanged at least one letter a year, even now. What's that, 30 years, six, or more than 30 years, I mean 40 years. He's still living in Pindi. He got various jobs, of course, but he's a very good fellow, and I say every Christmas we correspond. He sends me a letter, and I go to the bank and I send him a certain amount of money plus a letter. When the daughter got married that he knew, he sent her a very, very nice evening coat which he'd bought up in Srinagar in Kashmir as a wedding present. And to the son-in-law, the gunner, my daughter married the gunner, he sent a silver miniature cannon. He knew he was a gunner, and it was made in the bazaar, of course, and it's a very nice little memento. And I thought it very generous of him, very kind of him to done so. They do, generally, if you have a good bearer, and most people get good bearers, they're very loyal and very friendly and serve one very well.